Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I am Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
What number show is this?
I think we might be at 98.
Okay, good. All right. So, yeah, we'll come up with a name, but it's not going to be Fox on Sports anymore. So,
Show number 100 will be about your birthday time.
Yes. Well, dude, you weren't supposed to tell when my birthday was. I don't have a birthday.
We talk about that every year. I mean, come on. You and Ichiro.
I am.
Celebrate it. We love it.
24 years old.
You are Ichiro's.
So there's that, at least mentally.
Twin. So we know you're more than 24. Ichiro played professional baseball for like 24 years. So
I know
you're older than 24.
Ichiro also had more hits than Pete Rose, although I'm sure Pete Rose is not admitting that. You know, it's so anyway, we're almost to show number 100. That feels momentous, but it's only momentous because the number 100 tends to, for whatever reason, it's mystical. And you think about like the weird things that work out in baseball, you know, people who have a love affair with the game, and I'm one of them, but I never really fell into this whole thing. Oh, it's such a magical game. 60 feet, 6 inches. The diamond is 90 feet. If not for the fact that it was that distance, you wouldn't have all these close plays. You know, like talking about those things, the one thing that to me is interesting is you have a mark for a pitcher, which delineates, are they a hard thrower now or are they kind of average to above average in the major leagues? 100 miles an hour. That hasn't changed.
That's a high mark.
That's
not the mark I would use for are they a hard thrower.
It used to be when we were kids, or, you know, I'm slightly older than you are, even though I'm not willing to admit it. There was one guy that could throw 100 miles an hour. It was Nolan Ryan. And that was for 25 years he's pitching in the major leagues throwing 100 miles an hour. I would still say the high 90s are a good spot to be. Far more guys break 100, but for whatever reason, it's that high 90s kind of verging on 100 miles an hour that is the magic number for pitchers. And we have been very lucky to see one pitching for the Astros over these last few days. Garrett Cole, who wound up setting a record for strikeouts in a playoff series.
He doesn't show up at the ballpark without getting at least 10 strikeouts.
It's absurd. And when you think about the fact that the Astros did not build a pitching staff by drafting their pitching staff. They built their pitching staff by trading for their pitching staff. And somebody was foolish enough to give to the Astros what they needed in order to build this staff. The Pirates traded four guys to the Astros, or received four guys from the Astros, unloaded Garrett Cole at the beginning of the 2018 season to a team that was a defending world champion.
Yes, that is true. I feel like we talked about that on the show.
Right.
That was the Pittsburgh Pirates show that we did. We talked about McCutchen and Cole and all the changes they made.
Right. But you look at that and you say, okay, this team really has an absurd amount of riches. And Garrett Cole is one who, he had always been a solid pitcher with Pittsburgh. He won close to 60 games in 5 years with them. But now he's at a point where he has a stacked starting lineup with him. He's throwing, not touching 100, but he's in the high 90s. And he's in rarefied air. And we've seen it. And my favorite example is 31 years ago. And the Dodgers still aren't going to get off the schneid this year. We'll talk about that later. But you look at teams who ride one horse all the way through, and it was never more apparent than with the Dodgers and Hershiser in 88 when the rest of their team was pretty marginal. And you had one guy who was head and shoulders, get on my shoulders, I'm going to carry you. Houston has, by all rights, two really good other pitchers in that rotation, Verlander and Zach Greinke, and nobody's talking about them.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, and it's funny to hear you call Verlander really good. He could win the Cy Young. He's been dominant for quite some time.
It's not
so much in his last outing.
Right. No, not in his last outing, but there have been a number of guys in baseball history who are not necessarily Hall of Famers. And I'll go back to Hershiser. He's not a Hall of Famer. He won, I think, 203 games. Not a Hall of Famer, but Curt Schilling's another one, regardless of where you land as far as what you think of Curt Schilling now, whether businessman or tweeter. But John Lackey, to me, is another one. There are some guys who are just game five guys or game seven guys. Chris Carpenter, our fellow Bedford resident, is a clinching game guy. There are some guys that just go, yep, give me the ball. Cole is, for whatever reason, that guy. And this is a relative. Scherzer, to me, is that guy.
Yes,
the
he
guy
is.
Who, like, he'll look at you with his different colored eyes, and you're not taking the ball. Kevin Brown.
His
was
eyes,
another one.
His eyes are different, but they are aligned in their purpose and their focus.
Oh yeah, dude. But I guess my overall point is, you can win a Cy Young Award. There are plenty of very good pitchers who've won a Cy Young Award, but I'm not even going to hazard a guess at a percent. A lot of the guys who have won Cy Young Awards in their career, John Denny, Steve Stone, you wouldn't want going out there for you in Game 7. But then there are a ton of pitchers who never won a Cy Young Award that if they were like, I threw five innings the day before, or seven innings the day before, and I'm going to go out there and win you the World Series, you'd be like, here you go.
He does fall in that category. He was amazing in the postseason. You know, looking at your shirt, the first word that comes to mind for these guys, Bulldogs.
That's Hershiser's nickname.
There you go.
There you go.
They want the ball.
Gave him that nickname.
They want the ball in the playoffs, and they rise to the occasion.
And so you look at those, and you say, all right, that's a certain type of pitcher. And it's not, I don't even know that I would call it an ace. I don't know that I would call it a stopper. It's a guy that just, it's like Keyshawn Johnson's book. I was thinking about it this morning when I was watching him on ESPN. Just give me the damn ball. Just like, get me out there and let me throw it. And you know that I might be a puddle of something on the mound at the end, but like, I am going to give you whatever. I'm going to compete. And not lowercase capital compete.
Well, they relish the challenge. And if there's something happening with the team, like a losing streak or a loss in Game 4, making Game 5 do or die situation, they don't ignore that. They use it to fuel themselves
right to
greater heights.
And I remember, like, Clemens is another one that I would think of as an example. I think it was that 85 season for him when was he like 24-4? I mean, he put up video game stats that year, but he had a record of like 14-0 after a loss. Like, he was the stopper for them. And so there are a number of guys that you look at and you say, okay, and so getting back to it, like, that's why Verlander's very good. And most of the guys I know would trade places with Verlander in a second, you know, for a variety of reasons. Pitching in the major leagues, married to a supermodel. Hey, you know, but you look at that and you say, is he the guy that is going to close the series out? Not necessarily. Is Cole at this point the guy? Sure. Yes. Is looking at the Dodgers, is Walker Buehler the guy? And we're not going to talk about the Dodgers yet. Don't get excited. Is Walker Buehler the guy? Like, Texan, ice cold, water running through his veins. Is that the guy that's going to do it? Or is it going to be Kershaw? And that's, like, I don't know how to quantify it, but it's, there are guys who are legitimate big game pitchers. It's, Robert Ori is not an NBA Hall of Famer, but I can't think of too many other people I would have wanted taking the big shot at the end of the game than Robert Ori.
Yeah, don't they call him Big Shot Rob?
Big Shot Rob. That's, you know, there are just some guys who just like, nah, I just don't care.
Well, for the Astros, it may just be whoever gets the first chance to close out the ALCS will do it.
I hope so.
And it could be an epic series with the Yankees and the Astros. So who do you give the nod to when you've got those three aces, Cole, Verlander, Greinke, facing up against those power bats from New York?
If I was ranking them, I'd rank them just as you rank them. Cole is my A of that, or one of that. Verlander is 1A and Greinke is 1B. Just, I've seen him melt down too many times at weird occasions in weird ways, and that's just from being a Dodger fan, Royal fan. There are just some times that you just look and he just does things, and this will kind of touch on another point. He does things where he's almost trying to be too smart for the game, and at the point in time when you're a big game pitcher, you're not thinking anymore. You're just like, you're operating with a store of information that you have gathered over decades of doing this, and you're just relying on the fact that you're competitive, and in some ways you need to think a little bit, but it's mostly on autopilot at that point. You are somewhere else. You're not there. So it's I hope it's the Astros, because I can't watch games at Yankee Stadium. I just can't.
Yeah.
Cannot stand to watch it on TV. You know, sorry, Yankee fans. It's just the, I don't know, those seats down low where people kind of half come and half don't. And like, I'm all set. I don't need that anymore. But the, it would be nice to see Houston there. In thinking about a couple more things, and this goes back to the game last night, and this is Friday and you're listening on Saturday or Sunday. As we think about that, the thing that has come up today is, depending on your perspective, Tyler Glasnow for Tampa either tipping his pitches or the Astros stealing signs. And I guess one thing that I'd like to throw out is I don't think stealing signs should be called stealing signs.
I don't either.
It's taking signs.
Yeah.
It's, if you're stupid enough to hold your glove in a certain way or to have a tell every time something happens, you deserve to get picked. And there's no, like, there are people talking this morning, well, do you think they should have stolen signs? If you're in business and somebody walks up to you and says, you know, and granted, I'm not advocating for insider trading here, but if somebody says, hey, every time Company X has issued a financial statement that says Y and their stock tends to go down 10%, like, there's nothing insider about that. It's just, it's stimulus response. So if I look and Glasnow is up here, glove is high or glove is low, and he's telling me what he's going to throw, I'm foolish if I don't act accordingly.
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, think about other sports, tendencies, what you see, your instincts. You're guarding somebody in basketball. If he starts to move the ball in a certain direction and you've learned over time, that means he's going to drive left or he's going to, you know, dribble right and then do a step back three-pointer. Why would you not take advantage of that information to give your team an edge?
Right. It's access to information. There's nothing cheating about it. And like, the reason that you don't have a third base, well, the original reason is there was a player for the Cincinnati Red Stockings back in the 1800s who was hearing impaired, and that necessitated the use of signs. But there are nearly no players in the major leagues that are hearing impaired anymore. So the original reason that we use signs is no longer valid. We're using them to communicate a message without speaking to somebody. If we want to just say the message to somebody and have it be open for everybody to hear, hey, hit and run. We'll say hit and run. Like, I mean, you see it at the younger levels with baseball where, okay, there's a runner's on first and second and the guy going up to hit goes down to the coach's box. All right, what's coming next? Probably a bunt. Like,
right.
You know.
There's another one. If you see the batter conferencing with the third base coach, are you supposed to close your eyes and pretend you're not seeing that?
Right. I mean, so none of this is stealing signs. If you don't want to tell the opposition what you're doing, don't tell them. You went to Princeton. You guys probably had chapter and verse of everything that everybody did and were the kings of stealing signs.
Yeah. I remember one guy who was from the Boston area who it seemed like that was one of his specialties. He took pride in being able to predict the other team's actions. We didn't talk about it as a team, but I do recall that.
I mean, I've always been bad at it. I would consider myself in that realm as a dumb smart guy. Like, I'm marginal at it. I still remember, and we may have talked about it on the show, I don't recall. It was my senior year of high school. We were playing against the number one ranked team in Orange County, California, and their coach, if he wanted the pitcher to throw an off-speed pitch, he was sitting on a bucket. They were in the first base dugout. He was sitting on a bucket and would put down a fist. And if it was the fist, it was an off-speed pitch. If it was an open hand, it was a fastball. And
that's some complicated signage right there.
I mean, seriously, like, that's the number one team in a county where the baseball is pretty good. And we picked it up a couple batters in and said, all right, dude, and this was player driven, not coach driven. If we yell your first name, it's going to be a fastball. If we yell your last name, it's going to be a curveball. That team didn't figure it out. We scored 9 in the first inning, went from unranked to like top 5 in the county and a nice little winning streak. And like, to me, if you're going to have a sign system that's that simple, get ready to get them picked.
Exactly.
Like, come up with something better.
Right.
Like, there's a reason in World War II that there were Navajo code talkers because we needed a code that could not be cracked. Okay, so we used native Navajo speakers to communicate because the enemy in the war could not pick that up. If we wanted to just say a message, you just say a message. Well, they're not listening. They're not listening to this channel.
Right.
Like, and I realize, like, and, you know, for the four of you who are listening, probably one of you might say, but baseball isn't war. I realize, but there are a lot of tendencies within these games where, like, people treat it like that, where they are extremely competitive about winning and losing. And so, you know, and we all are to a degree, otherwise we wouldn't be playing. So don't give the signs away.
Exactly.
Simple. Yeah. Like, don't tip it.
You scored 9 in that first inning in that high school game. The Cardinals scored 10 in the first inning against the Braves. I wonder if they had the Brave signs.
I don't think they needed them. Fultonevich was just bad. Like, and sometimes, like, and that.
Well, if McCann catches that strikeout pitch against the first batter, maybe it never happens.
Truly. You can't play it that way. But, you know, I don't know. His game score was 16. For those who don't know what a game score is, you basically start with 50. If something good happens, you get points. If something bad happens, you take points away. So a good game in the major leagues, game score is 80. You know, anything that's average-ish is 60, you know, is in the 55, 65, 65 and up. You're talking, you pitched a pretty good game. Fultonevich's was 16.
That sums it up right there.
It's just bad.
Didn't make it out of the first
inning. That was, I believe, if memory serves correctly, that was the worst game score in the history of the postseason in professional baseball.
Well, the error at first didn't help either. Ground ball to Freeman that he booted to the right.
Yeah.
So just nothing going right for the Braves that day.
Right. So anyway, they still have some solid young players. That'll be a lot of fun to watch as we go. And then we'll call Coach Matthews in a couple minutes here and get him on. But thinking about the Dodgers, a team with absolutely no business losing that series. None.
Yep. Had home field.
None.
Leading late in the game 3-1. And Dave Roberts calls on Mr. Kershaw to come in relief. And there was an article on ESPN talking about the decisions that Roberts made and didn't make late in that game.
Ugh.
Before you know it, 3-1 lead turns into a 7-3 loss. Would you have brought Kershaw in there up by 2 runs with Soto waiting in the wings? But first he's got to go through Rendon, the right-handed hitter. Rendon goes deep. Soto goes deep. 3-1 lead all of a sudden becomes 3-3 tie.
There's not a chance that I would have brought Clayton Kershaw in. 0% chance. And Dave Roberts has watched to this point in the season, that was game number 167, not to mention spring training. So, and I don't remember how many starts Kershaw made because he has his usual midseason sabbatical where he's injured with something. And that's, I'm not begrudging him that at all. Like, I love him as a competitor. I think he's a great pitcher. I think he's a Hall of Famer. And I think in the regular season, he is one of the best to have ever done it. The problem is Clayton Kershaw at 31 is not Clayton Kershaw at 25. And
he's only 31?
Yeah.
He seems like he's 35 already.
He came up when he was young. I mean, he didn't stay in the minors long. Like, he skipped us in Inland Empire. He was gone to Jacksonville before that. But the problem that I have with it is if you, and I haven't watched all of his starts. I've watched enough of his starts. If you watch Clayton Kershaw, he has, by and large, lost the ability to put anybody away. Gets ahead in a count, and it's foul ball, foul ball, foul ball, something. And, like,
he's nowhere near that magic number of 100.
No, he's not. He's at 90. And the other thing that has happened, and, you know, he'll fix it, and then it goes back to doing it again, and it did it at the wrong time. That thing happened at the wrong time. His fastball and his slider, which his slider is his out pitch, look really similar. It's because of his arm angle, and the slider doesn't bite. The slider slides. And so Kershaw is throwing a fastball that is 89-90 and a slider that is like 86-87 and really winds up as a hanging slider. And so if I want to get outs and I'm facing Rendon and Soto, that is not the guy I go to under any circumstances at all. Kenta Maeda, I think, and we've seen it the last couple of years, Maeda, for me, has been one of the most reliable guys coming out of that Dodger bullpen. And for whatever reason, he continues to get the shaft because people think that they need to, this is the playoffs, we need to outsmart the game. And and Dave Martinez to some degree did it, but it was like, I forget who I've talked to about it. With the Dodgers, you're talking about a rock solid bullpen or pretty close to it, where it's Baez and Joe Kelly's been shaky, but that's another story. And Maeda's been down there and he's been great. And Kolarik, I mean, you have all these guys that are good. The bullpen is not your problem. You don't need to take one of your starters and bring him in the seventh inning to be fancy. You don't. If you're the Washington Nationals, you need to do that because your bullpen is hideous. So Roberts is managing like he's got a Washington Nationals bullpen for really no reason. And it's just inconceivable to me that becomes a logical good thing to do there. And then Kershaw gives up 2 home runs and 3 pitches and immediately walks off the field. And you feel horrible for him because now it's not only the physical aspect, it's the mental aspect. He gets to think about that all offseason. But then to have Joe Kelly come in, who really, I don't know in all the years that I've watched baseball that I've ever seen a guy who's more Jekyll and Hyde than Joe Kelly is.
Seriously, even in the same game, like in this instance.
You get him throwing 10 pitches in the ninth inning, and granted, he hadn't thrown more than one inning in a game, I think, since August 24th. You have him do that, and then he comes back in the 10th inning, and, well, you know what's going to happen. There's a leadoff walk. Well, 70% of the time, that comes around to score, so you know you're toast. Then a double off the wall or in the wall, as
it
were.
Yeah.
There are some who have argued with the idea of walking Soto to load the bases. Again, that's one. If you're arguing with me, you're not going to win that argument because you're taking a guy who's red hot, who's pumped up. I'm putting him on base and I'm setting up a force out anywhere. And I'll take my chances with Howie Kendrick. The only problem is if you're Joe Kelly, you can't leave a pitch of the belt for Howie Kendrick when the guy's trying to hit a fly ball to tie the game.
Right.
Like, so, do I look at Kershaw and say it's Kershaw's fault? No, Kershaw shouldn't have been out there. That's the manager's fault. Do I look at it and say that, if I'm managing, I go right to Maeda right after Buehler because I know that Maeda can sit after an out, wait, he's a starting pitcher, come back. He's fine. He doesn't have the big name that Kershaw does, but you're really not losing anything by going to him. So there's that. There's the... I don't know why in the bottom of the inning you come back and you hit A.J. Pollock, who, like, if you want a guy who's going to strike out 11 times in 13 at-bats, I'm here.
That's your guy?
I'm here.
Oh, you're
like,
oh, you're the
you
guy.
Want a guy
okay.
who's going to strike out 11 and 13 in the major leagues? I could do that.
As can A.J.?
As can A.J. Pollock. He's just getting paid a lot more. Like, so you just, you look and you go, like, I don't know. It's just, like, if I'm the Dodgers at this point, what do I do? Well, I can't do anything with Kershaw because he's making $30 million a year. Can't do anything with some of the other guys with big contracts. Honestly, I'd probably unload Cody Bellinger, get myself a little bit of pitching because whatever he's doing in the regular season or however he's getting pitched in the regular season sure isn't what he's seeing in the postseason, and he is not going to figure it out. Somebody brought it up. His comparison swing-wise is Ted Williams, and they were both about the same in the postseason. Both
yeah, hit, I noticed
that 200-ish.
Low 200 average as he walked off after that last strikeout and thought the same thing.
Yeah, it's so, you got to, if you're the Dodgers, the status quo is not working. So figure out what's going to work. But, obviously. And the other thing that just really sucks about being here is that game ends at about 1 in the morning. You can't go to bed. So you wake up Thursday on 3.5 hours of sleep. Like, thanks. Thanks, Dodgers. Thanks for nothing. Go back to L.A. Have a nice offseason. All right. We're going to take a quick break. I'm late. Coach Zach Matthews is going to make me do a whole bunch of up, downs, and push-ups. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, and... we are once again joined by the coach of the Bedford High football team, or should I say the 5-0 Bedford High football team, Zach Matthews. Coach, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Coach, let's start with a review of last week's comeback win, 31-14 over Central. They came out with quite a game plan, running almost every play out of the shotgun with 5 wide receivers. How much of a surprise was that, and how do you think the team held up to that attack?
Well, I mean, I guess there's 2 parts to that answer. We obviously haven't seen Central. Central hasn't run any empty, you know, all year long. So to come out in the gun with five wides, I mean, that was definitely not something we'd seen from them this year or in past years, to be honest. And so that was something totally different. But we have talked to our kids, and this is a compliment to our kids and the things that they're doing. But every week has been something different. You know, people are trying to throw different things at us, things that we don't expect. And that's a compliment to our kids and the football that they're playing right now. People know that they have to try to do different things to kind of get us off our game. And to be honest, I mean, I think that it took a little bit for our kids to settle in. I thought for the most part we did a really good job, you know, against that attack. I think there was a couple big plays that they had, you know, a couple contested catches, a couple really nice throws. But overall, I mean, I was pretty pleased with how the kids responded to that.
Yeah, that was really strange to see that they ended up throwing over 50 times. But you're right, the team certainly adjusted well on the fly, and that'll be good experience moving forward. Now, one of the most incredible plays of the season happened in the fourth quarter, or late in the second half, and I'm just going to call it the tackle by Joseph Michael, and I'll describe the play briefly. You guys were trying to punch it in on fourth down at the goal line, and in the middle of the pile, somehow Central comes away with the ball, and their defender starts running towards the sideline and then up the sideline. Looks like he's going to go in for a go-ahead touchdown, but Joseph Michael somehow takes the perfect angle and makes a shoestring tackle just past midfield. What were your thoughts and emotions as you watched that play unfold?
Well, I mean, I guess I probably can't share with you all of my thoughts and emotions. Because to be honest, I thought that Jack was laying in the end zone and the ball had clearly crossed the plane of the end zone. To be honest, I was a little bit shocked as to what was going on because it was kind of a scrum. You couldn't see a lot of what was going on, but it looked to me like he was laying in the end zone, and then all of a sudden there's no whistle and the ball's going down the opposite sideline. So I guess the first thing I would say is I was a little bit shocked. And, you know, then secondly, I was just impressed with his personal effort on that play. I mean, he was really the only kid who could have made the tackle. He was the only kid who had any sort of angle. And you talk about, you know, effort and persistence and making a play for your team. And that was absolutely huge at that point in the game.
It's interesting too, because obviously I wasn't at the game, and Hanson and I were talking about it earlier. If you watch NFL and college, and I don't remember who I was talking to about it earlier this week, but I feel like I've seen this epidemic of quarterbacks on, you know, and it looks like it's going to be a pick six, and the guy is running hard, acting like he's going to make a tackle, and takes the worst possible angle at it, so he kind of shies away from contact. In the Pats Giants game last night, the thing that really stood out was Daniel Jones trying to make a tackle on a fumble recovery that was going toward the end zone, and he went right after it. Looked like a pretty textbook tackle too. So in a day and age when quarterbacks seem to be shying away from that, you have a sophomore quarterback that's just getting right after it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that first of all, we don't have enough kids in our program to first get to say, oh, is it just this, is it just that? So, you know, in the preseason, part of our preseason practices, everybody works on tackling. Everybody works on pursuit angles. Everybody works on tackling in open space. Obviously, as we get into the regular season, Joe's not doing a whole lot of tackling. But, you know, it's nice to see that some of those drills we do in the preseason, as far as tracking ball carriers and pursuit angles and tackling in the open field, it's obviously nice to see that pay off in a situation where it obviously was a pretty big play in that game.
Yeah, he obviously paid attention, because that was textbook, really impressive. And then, of course, he added the extra point later in the game as well, so he's been practicing a little bit of kicking here and there too.
Yeah, well, he's a kid who started out as a soccer guy when he was younger. So, you know, played a lot of soccer as a kid and coming up through the ranks and really only started playing football a couple years ago. So he's fairly new to the game of football, and thankfully, you know, with that soccer background, that helps us out in the kicking game as well.
Well, speaking of his versatility, you look at Solomon Sanchez, and he had another big game. He had a touchdown reception and a pick six in the second half. How important has his versatility been to the team's success this season?
Yeah, I mean, you look at what Solomon has done, and what a lot of people wouldn't know is that Solomon was actually involved in the quarterback competition throughout the summer. And really going into the preseason, we had talked to Solomon. It was not that he couldn't play quarterback or couldn't have the ability to do that. I just look at his skill set, and he's got really good hands. He's really athletic. He runs really aggressively and can, you know, run in space. And so I think one of the deals with me was I was looking at Solomon's skill set and saying, I think we've got to use this kid somewhere else because I think he can be a threat to make our offense that much better. And so he's definitely lived up to that billing. And, you know, and then when you talk about games like the big ones that are coming up on the schedule, games like the Londonderry game here, I mean, this is a kid who doesn't shy away from those big moments. You know, he looks forward to those moments of playing against the best competition, and I think, you know, you'll see his best football.
Yeah, we would expect nothing less after watching him in the first five games of the season. And you mentioned tonight's matchup. It is the big showdown against your undefeated Bulldogs and the undefeated Londonderry Lancers. How was the week of practice heading up to this showdown for you?
Yeah, to be honest, I mean, I think it was a normal week of practice. I think that that's the testament to our kids and what they do to prepare for each opponent we have. You know, I don't think, obviously, the kids know what's on the table. I think they're not immune to, you know, the press and everybody talking about the game. But as far as the work they do on the field, it's not, you know, we don't see a whole lot of different intensity because I think our kids bring intensity to practice every single day. You know, I think was there an added little bit of focus this week? I think there definitely was. I think we saw a little bit more focus, but for the most part, it was a normal week of practice. You know, we tried to keep the routine pretty much the same for the kids. You know, and the reality of it is that this is just another regular season game for us. You know, I think it's really big, obviously, for media and a lot of people outside the program. For our kids, it's another regular season game. Is it an exciting regular season game? Is it the best team we've played yet? It absolutely is. And I think our kids understand that as well. But, you know, I think it was business as usual this week at practice, and I think that that's what I would want from the kids. I wouldn't want to see a big uptick, I guess, in intensity that tells me that we're not preparing the right way for the past 5 weeks. And so I think the nice part is our kids are very even-keeled, and they're looking at this game and excited for the opportunity.
Well, that's certainly what you want as a coach, is to have the guys bring the same intensity week in and week out. We also know that you take time to study the film on your upcoming opponents. What are some of the strengths of Londonderry that you've been focusing on with your preparation this week?
Well, I mean, I think when you look at their offensive production, I mean, I think their lowest output this year has been 42 points. And so when you talk about that, I think specifically Londonderry's offense, they're a very athletic group. Even up front, their linemen are very athletic. You see a lot of pulling. And so what I would say is, you know, number one, we've got to do our best to control their athleticism. And their offense has been making a living off of explosive plays, you know, plays of 20-plus yards. And those are huge momentum changers in games. And so the biggest thing for us is trying to contain some of those athletes. You know, we understand that they're going to make some plays tonight, but not allowing, you know, the 60-yard play, the 70-yard play, some of those game-changing plays, and trying to have them, making them drive the field and execute for 10 plays instead of giving a one- or two-play drive and allowing them to come away with 6 points. So, you know, I think the athleticism is something that jumps out. You know, and I think they're definitely a very hungry team. You can tell they play with a lot of emotion. They play with a lot of energy, and they're excited about the group that they have. And so I think that one of the best things about this week is our kids know that we're going to have to play our best football in order to come out with a win. And so, you know, some of the mistakes we've had in previous weeks, there's a very small margin for error tonight. And our kids know that, and we're going to have to play much cleaner football to come out on the positive side of this one.
It'll be a lot of fun to watch the rest of this one coming up. And, Coach, thank you so much for always taking the time with us, and good luck in the second half.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That was Coach Zach Matthews of the Bedford High football program. So if you're looking at it now, Londonderry, according to Max Preps, is one. Bedford, according to Max Preps, is two after having held that one spot the whole season. Should be interesting to watch these two go head-to-head. Bedford has had, I would call him even just a little tiny bit of a learning curve or a little bit of bumps in the road. But the thing, when you talk to Coach Matthews, is it seems like he's doing his best to make sure that his team can learn from everything that they've been taught along the way. The game really is the best way to learn. All right, this is what you have to work on. This is what we're already solid with. So it seems like he's well aware of that. And how do they continue to improve and refine what they're doing as they face Londonderry, which, if you're listening, Saturday morning was last night. But Londonderry is always tough.
Yeah, and he touched on the fact that the opponents so far this season have come up with different offensive plans to try to attack Bedford and find a way to keep it close, give themselves a chance in the second half. So I think the team is really going to benefit in the long run from seeing these different offensive attacks. I mean, you look back at the season opener against Wyndham, they're running this triple option where they almost never wanted to throw the ball until the very end of the game when they realized they had to. The game was over at that point. And then you look at Central last week coming in, they're known as a team with the regular I rushing attack, you know, rushing out of the I formation. And then you didn't see that play a single time the entire game. It was incredible. They threw the ball over 50 times. They didn't have a running back line up in the backfield before the snap until there were about 3 minutes left in the fourth quarter. Not a single play. And so his team has to adapt on the fly. And guys that, I mean, you can't practice for that if they've never shown it. You don't expect that they're not going to run the ball outside of a jet sweep for the first, you know, 45 minutes of the game. So I think they've done a great job adjusting on the fly to these different offensive formations.
Right. And if you're thinking about it too, like the other teams are spending a lot of time game planning to show something that's entirely different than what Bedford has seen before, which really, in a lot of ways, the ultimate compliment. Like, they are realizing that, okay, what we are typically doing, if we give them that exact same look, we're not going to stand a chance to beat them. The coaches have to look and say, wait a second, we're seeing something that's entirely different than what we saw before. So it does require some scheming on the fly. Fortunately, you have a lot of players in this program who have played at a wide variety of levels. They're very athletic, intelligent players. So add all that stuff up, and Bedford's got a good shot. Now, against Londonderry, which is the number one team, really anything can happen, and you're not permitted against a better team really any mistakes.
No, and so the other thing he mentioned there was the big play element to a big game like this, and that's another thing I think Bedford's done a great job at this season is limiting the opponent's big plays. The defense keeps you in front. They haven't made many mistakes behind them. You know, they've been making the big plays offensively. And of course that's the balance you want, and they've had that right balance throughout the season so far.
So looking at these two teams, looking at the head to head matchups, there's not a whole lot of difference. They've played a couple teams that are similar. Concord, Londonderry beat them 48-6. Bedford earlier in the season when they were still kind of getting their feet under them, won it 16-0, if memory serves there. And then Wyndham 49-3. Bedford had, what, a
41-7.
Yeah, so yep. A 34-point differential. These guys beat them by 46. So, you know, that's kind of academic there. There's not a whole lot of difference between them. As far as Londonderry goes, because you've done more game prep because you're actually doing the game, who are the players to watch for on their roster?
I actually don't know the names yet. I haven't seen their tape, so I don't have the answers for you on that one.
Yeah, I'm sitting
as
here.
As of Friday at 11 a.m.
Right, there's still plenty of time on that. I'm sitting here.
You can ask me about that tomorrow.
Looking at their roster saying, wait a second, are there any players that are familiar names for us from basketball? But outside of the guys who have numbers on this, there aren't a whole lot. The only name that I really see, one for you to keep an eye on tonight, Colby Ramshaw, who is Mike Ramshaw from the Fisher Cats. Oldest son.
All right.
Offensive lineman. So Ramshaw is one to watch for, of course, always. But yeah, good luck to Zach Matthews and the rest of the crew. And then as we're looking at other sports as well, were you doing boys or girls soccer last night?
Thursday night was boys soccer.
Okay.
And that was a fun experience.
Did you find a victim to go into the booth with you?
I didn't.
You were solo.
It was me, myself, wow. And I talking about soccer. And it was, that was a different experience, but it was a lot of fun. I was glad to have done one broadcast earlier in the season, that 1-1 tie against Wyndham with Matt Dion, and get a chance to learn the players this season. But I think Coach Pepper has to be really proud with how the team played Thursday night. It ended up being a 2-0 shutout over Nashua South, and they came in 8-2-1 in fourth place. So Bedford remains undefeated. 11-0-1. They have now shut out six consecutive opponents after the 1-1 tie. And for the season, they've scored 48 goals and given up two. How's that for a...
That's a solid goal differential, really.
And you know, if you look back to the interview we did with Coach Pepper, one of the things he talked about was trying to have the team find the balance between individual excellence and possessing the ball as a team. And I think they did a great job with that last night. They were just constantly winning balls in the midfield, putting pressure forward. I mean, Vitor Rodriguez was just relentless on the attack. Even if there were three or four defenders, he was pushing, pushing, pushing. And, you know, you're not going to get many goals on a 1v4, but one of the goals that Bedford scored was it started with that. He pushed forward one against three, found a way to cross the ball into the middle, and then before you know it, shot on goal, rebound, shot, Statiris had scored. So, you know, you can't always see the direct result of Vitor's speed and individual moves, but the attention he draws, I think, led to one of those goals. And, you know, Statiris also stood out with a goal and assist. He was all over the field. Flanagan was back. He was all over the field. So, you know, a lot of positive things to draw from that game. And then next Tuesday, Bedford is going to travel to Central.
Yep.
And that'll be a rematch of the state championship game. Central only has one loss this season. So they're in second. Bedford's in first. So it's sort of like the football matchup, one versus two. Two heavyweights going at it should be a fun matchup.
Yeah, it should be. Those games are always, the Bedford Central games are always very physical. And it'll be nice to have that test at this point in the season so that regardless of what happens, because at this point you wind up banged up from one way or another, you get the chance to see what really needs to be worked on and then build things back up. Playoffs start right at the end of the month. So there's still a little bit of time between now and then. It's not like you're one and they're two, and if you lose that last one before the regular season ends, now all of a sudden momentum's against you. If you lose this game, you still have the opportunity to come back, figure things out. So, but if you wind up winning that one, all right, you basically, for all intents and purposes, you've locked up that number one seed. So, you know, for Bedford, there's a lot to play for, and then for the girls, still looking pretty solid as well. I don't know. They had a game a week ago against Concord, beat them 1-0. I don't know what happened this week. Did you happen to see any of that?
I have not.
So we're going to be utterly useless as far as that goes unless I can find something pretty quick. So I'm hitting the Google hard, but, you know, we'll see what we can find. You would think that I would do prep for this, but obviously not. The girls won on Wednesday, 1-0 over. I knew that already. I had had a conversation with somebody about it. The JV won 5-4. The varsity won 1-0. That was Wednesday at BG. Then they take on Nashua South tonight at 4 o'clock at Nashua South, obviously, because there's a football game at our place at 7 o'clock at night. So
that's last night if you're listening on Saturday.
That's last night if you're listening on Saturday. Yeah. As my brain continues to,
spin
and explode. So, yeah, but on the fall athletic front, things are looking solid. Soccer teams both doing very well. The golf team, we haven't gotten an update in a while on the Runaway Bulldog website. So come on now, get on it. We need the help.
Where's our update? Where's our written update?
We need more written updates, but there's nothing there. We tried to get Coach Dan Colbert on, but unfortunately, he's not the easiest one, or I guess maybe we're not the easiest ones for him with when we usually record the show. He's in class pretty much all day Friday. So.
Right, so we can't blame that on him.
No, we can't blame it on him. It's
some
our
credit
fault.
For that one.
Yeah, we will have him on the show. He's always a good interview. And yeah, so anything else you want to touch on the high school front?
I think that covers it.
What else did we have?
I will mention that if you haven't yet and you want to see some of these games, highlights, broadcasts, if you go to YouTube and search Bedford Community Television NH, that's where you can find the YouTube page with all of these game videos. You can subscribe to that, get updates of when the game videos are ready, and that's a one-stop shop for some of these fall games that we've done. And if you're interested in that play that we talked about with Coach Matthews, I actually want to mention it again because I think it was a legendary tackle. It was absolutely phenomenal. And it's worth watching.
Fine,
we didn't broadcast that game at Central. They wouldn't let us bring in video.
Okay,
they said there's no room in the press box for visiting video, so we did radio only. But Manchester Central, they videotaped the game, so the video that you see on the YouTube channel is the Manchester video. It's not ours, not our broadcast. But if you go to the 38, if you go to the point in the broadcast where there's 38 minutes left, you're going to see that fourth down play. And I mean, you know, I think you'll come away feeling the same way I did about the play. Just it's one of those plays that not in, in a vacuum, it would be an incredible play. But at that stage in the game where it's 18-14 Bedford and they're about to punch it in to make it a 10-point lead, but somehow Manchester Central gets the ball and they are looking like they are going to go 100 yards for the fumble recovery return touchdown. And that would put them ahead late in the second half. And you never know what can happen after that. Maybe Bedford loses, and who knows how that might affect playoff seeding. I mean, it was a game-saving tackle, and it's also such an exciting play that it can motivate you and you know, take you to the next level for the rest of the season, potentially. I mean, the guys are going to look back on that and say, wow, I mean, Joseph, you saved the game for us on that play. You know, you kept us in first place, and who knows what that might do in terms of an impact on the rest of the season.
I forgot that they were playing that game at the Oakland Coliseum.
Yeah, right? A little baseball field out there, right, in the middle of everything.
I'm sitting here watching it at Gill. Well, I'm not at Gill. I'm here right now, but they're at about the 13-yard line. So if you hear me fall out of my chair, that might be the point in time at which the play is made. I think, you know, it needs, no, I see, I have it here now.
Okay.
You
all don't right.
have to
do all right.
So we've now gone to new depths of our program. But so anyway, get to this point. What I'll do is I'll take it and I'll put it on the Fox on Sports Facebook page.
Okay.
At this point, so that anybody that is really that curious to find out what went on in this fourth quarter play or this, when was it in the game?
It was, I actually don't remember if it was the very end of the third or the beginning of the fourth. This broadcast, they don't show the clock.
Right, there's no clock on it.
So I have it probably written down in my notes somewhere. But, I mean, if you like highlights, if you like the ESPN Top 10, you go watch this play, I think it's as good or better than any play in the NFL I've seen all season.
Why do we not send it to them?
Send what
we
to who?
We get Joseph Michael some run.
Yeah.
So here we go. Ball into the line. The ball somehow... Okay, they charge into the line and nothing. Oh, and then a player emerges from it. Here, that's the other thing, too. He's going back the other way. Michael somehow catches up to him against the near sideline and a shoestring tackle at about the 44-yard line. That's the only football I've done this year. And then a replay provided by BCTV.
Bill Jennings,
the replay?
Bill Jennings put in that slow-motion replay for everyone's benefit. And what is amazing is what happened at the goal line. You could not see it in regular action or in the regular replay, but in the slow motion replay, you see what's happening at the goal line, which is what Coach Matthews was talking about. Grogan is, first of all, it looks like his initial forward progress gives him the touchdown. And if anything, he stood up, but then he reaches the ball out. It has to be across the goal line.
Right. It
has to be.
You have a couple choices at that point, and that's what makes the play interesting if you're thinking through it. It's one of two things. It's either a touchdown or he's down by contact. And you usually don't see the officials come to the center of the field until they're spotting the ball and they're looking at each other to kind of gauge where the other one is and ultimately determine, is it across, is it not? So it's weird to me, watching it in real time, and if you go to the Facebook page, you'll see what I'm talking about. There is enough time that lapsed that it's somewhat surprising that that wasn't blown dead.
It had to have been blown dead at that point. It's either his forward progress is stopped and he's short.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Or he's you're going to continue the play, he reaches forward, and he's across the end line. I mean, you're not at the goal line from this vantage point, so we can't be certain, but just looking at it, I mean, it seems impossible that the ball didn't cross the goal line.
And it seems impossible that all of a sudden the ball, it's kind of one of those, you know, the whistle blows in a soccer game and somebody boots a goal in, or hockey and somebody dumps one in and you go, the play was long since dead. Like,
right,
what straws are you grasping at now? So, Bill Jennings, if you're listening, we need that Axis thing that they have, ESPN's got, like, BCTV should spring for that Axis thing, and that way we wouldn't have to have any arguments about this stuff anymore because we could see.
Or a pylon cam at a minimum.
Oh, pylon cam would be nice, yes. Why do we not have an NFL set up at the high school?
Seriously. Well, we can talk to Corey Parker about that,
Your
too.
Tax dollars at work. Yeah, no. So, but yeah, anyway, it is, yeah, that's a, it's a play for the ages. When you're talking about the tackle, I'm thinking he's going to separate the player from the ball at about the 40-yard line. But instead, what it was a really nice shoestring tackle and a textbook example of not giving up on a play.
And what else is kind of fun and impressive about it is that nothing got in his way mentally, even though it was a crazy play.
Yeah.
Most people would have completely stopped moving and checked out thinking that Grogan had scored or he'd been stopped. But he didn't quit on the play. And then as he's taking the perfect angle to that tackle, the entire sideline for Central is running as if they're going to go score the touchdown. I mean, everybody is cheering and running along with the actual ball carrier. It's almost looking like guys are out on the field flanking him, but it's no matter to Michael, and he makes the amazing tackle.
So, hey, good for him. Good for the Bulldogs, and they will take on Londonderry tonight at 7 o'clock, but hey, it's last night, so don't get any ideas if you're listening to the show tomorrow.
Right.
That you can actually go and watch a game today because it already happened.
Exactly.
Did I get that
straight? I hope you followed all that.
I don't think I got any of it straight. So we have in Major League Baseball now, getting back to that, we have two LCSs set up. We have St. Louis and Washington. We have Houston and New York. I already told you how I feel about watching games at Yankee Stadium, but I really do like that Astros lineup a whole lot. And really, at this point, Washington sort of has that team of destiny feel to them. I can tell you, I'm going to rank outcomes. My best possible outcome would be Astros Nationals, but because that's what I want, it won't happen. So just strike that from your mind. It will not happen. The outcome that I want to see the least is Cardinals Yankees. So that's the one that I would bank on happening.
Right.
Any other, you know, permutations in the Punnett Square are not going to happen. It's going to be Cardinals and Yankees, and I'm going to spend the World Series week throwing up in my mouth.
I agree with you that I do not want to see that matchup. My key here is as long as the Astros are involved in the World Series, I'll be satisfied. I'd be happy to see either National League team there. It's going to be a good story. And with the Nationals specifically, wouldn't it be interesting if the first year without Harper, they actually get there finally? And there was all this talk about you've got one of the best young hitters in baseball, and Bryce Harper, putting up just crazy numbers at his age. And you've got a pitching staff that includes Scherzer and Strasburg. And all you can think about is the chances they let slip away, the year they wouldn't even use Strasburg in the playoffs. And now they finally have the pitching staff. They don't have Harper, but this year they may actually get to the World Series.
And we've talked about Bryce Harper on the air, and I really like him, and I like how he plays. And a footnote to kind of carry along with Bryce Harper, I don't know if you saw Gabe Kapler lost his job.
I did see that.
And that goes back to the point that we were talking about earlier with Dave Roberts, where you can't try to outsmart the game. What we've seen in recent years, and there are a number of names that come to mind, I'm not going to say all of them. What we've seen in recent years is a lot of this manager is smart and look at the things that he does that are so different. And no, this is groundbreaking and nobody's thought of any of this before. Oh, and this is so amazing. And he's different, but he's smart and he's going to do nothing except win. And for whatever reason, those guys wind up on the scrap heap within about 2 or 3 years. And I don't know why. I mean, I can tell you why I think it is. I think that baseball is a simple game. You throw the ball, you catch the ball, you hit the ball. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose,
sometimes it rains.
Think about that for a while. The Bull Durham. But this is not, I guess if you were to coach a team and operate with like two principles, first of all, three principles, score more runs than the other guy.
That's always positive.
Which is two things. That's offense and defense, or I guess three things, offense, defense, and pitching. And the other things, happy cows give good milk. Have a good clubhouse where guys get along. Like when we talk to Chris Atterbury and he's talking about the Twins, who unfortunately got blown out by the Yankees, but I think, I mean, that was like big guy versus little guy. The overwhelming feeling, and when I had lunch with Atterbury at the beginning of September down in Boston, like, it was a happy clubhouse. It was a good place to be. And when guys want to go to the park every day and want to show up and want to play and want to play for their buddies and like and want to make plays for the pitchers and like, that is an underrated thing. But like the new agey, hippy dippy, whatever things that Gabe Kapler was trying to implement, like some things just don't work. And rules for the sake of rules also don't work. If you can say, hey, I'm asking you to do this because of this, great. But if I'm putting rules into place simply just so that I can, so you know who's boss, I don't think that has ever worked.
Yeah, and I agree. If you get the feeling that it's trying to be smart, then it has a much different feel. But on the flip side, down with the Rays, Cash and the opener, that has had solid success. And what's your take on what they're doing down there at Tropicana Field?
Unfortunately, it didn't work out, but I love the opener.
Yeah, like, they got to game five. I've not too shabby.
I've done it in youth games where, okay, if I can get through and... It's not a new thing. I mean, it's a new thing that it's done at the major league level, but Dirty Al did it with Isla Borders way back when. The thing is, if you can play with house money for as long as you can and get your best guy on the mound or your best guys on the mound at the highest leverage situations in the game, when you think through, like, people reacted with repulsion when Kevin Cash started using Sergio Romo as the opener. How is he doing this? Well, he doesn't have enough starting pitching. That's the commodity. What he's trying to do is get through the game, and he's doing it backwards, but it's okay. Like, once you get through your head that this isn't, I'm not being smart to be cute or to try to outsmart the game. I'm being smart because I'm trying to win.
I'm trying to keep the opposing hitters off balance and not let them settle into a routine where they know they're going to see the starting pitcher three times by the fifth or sixth inning. And then get him in the second or third at bat. You never know who you're going to face, and you're always adjusting to a new pitcher. It's a great idea. I'm not surprised it's been so successful.
No, and I there are going to be more like it, and that's I guess there's a difference between innovation with a purpose and innovation just to kind of make a mark. Like, if you're innovating, but you're innovating just to be different, that's one thing. If you're innovating because you have a reason and I think there's obviously the Red Sox in the sabermetric era have met with far greater success than the Red Sox pre-sabermetric era, when they can look at numbers and figure out what the undervalued things that they need to have in their lineup are. Or in the case of like Bill James, all right, Jason Veritek's retiring. What do we need to expend on a catcher in order to make sure that we don't lose much when Veritek's gone? Like, looking at a problem, a known problem, and trying to solve a problem. And in Cash's case, it's, I don't have enough starting pitching. Like, I don't have a guy that can go every 5 days. So I got to figure something out here. That's an answer to a solution. But throwing random things out there, and, you know, I will say Tony La Russa hitting the pitcher eighth, I didn't mind. Because it allowed him to bat McGuire higher in the lineup and allowed, okay, now you get a potentially higher leverage guy up earlier in the game, and it gives you that second leadoff man too once you're through the lineup the first time. Like, there are some things that make real sense when you think about them. Are you going to use them all the time? Not necessarily, but there are times that it makes sense to innovate, and then there are times that guys just go, well, I'm just going to do this because it just... seems like, and Gabe Kapler to me was the guy who, like, everything was about proving that he knew more than everybody else. And if you're the smartest guy in the room, you need to find another room.
There you go.
Like,
that's some good advice.
I don't know.
With La Russa batting the pitcher eighth, I remember that. How would that affect McGuire?
He comes up, and if he's hitting third, he's coming up instead of with two guys on, he's coming up with three guys on. Potentially. But the other thing is, it allows you to flip the lineup. And now that your number two guy comes up potentially with two guys on, there's more speed up. Instead of just giving that out up in the ninth slot, you're giving the out up one slot earlier.
And of course, you're in the National League, so you're going to pinch hit, and it's not going to matter as much as it does in the American League.
No. So, you know, but again, I'm okay with it if there's a reason for doing it. But if you're doing it just to be fancy, good luck. You'll wind up like Gabe Kapler. So, We didn't finish really talking about Harper and the Nats. We got sidetracked. But anyway, thank you to our guest, Zach Matthews. We're at the 1 hour plus mark. Harry's going to have to speed us up even more than we already are. Thank you to Harry Kozlowski, Bill Jennings, Colin Richardson, George Cox, and the rest of the crew here at Bedford 105.1. And thank you to you for listening. Have a wonderful sports week. Good luck, Bulldogs. You have been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.